Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Today is the day.
Good morning. Indeed, today is the day. It is Thursday, the 18th of July, 2019. So part of what I view as my responsibility, I have no idea if you view it this way, but I view part of my responsibility as reading lots and lots of headlines and curating lots and lots of news and information so you don't have to. So here are some things that did not make that newsreel at the top of the hour that I found interesting this morning. Paul McCartney is actually working on a set of songs for a stage musical that's an adaptation of It's a Wonderful Life, and it's going to release sometime in late 2020. Okay, so I think that's kind of cool. That's sort of like the cool news of the day in terms of something to look forward to. And then I got this. Let's see. Do not, by the way, if you have not already heard, do not download what's called Face App. If you already downloaded Face App and you are one of the 150 million people who uploaded your image to Face App so that you could manipulate it and see what you're going to look like when you're older, you made your likeness and your name eternally available to the Russians, because that's who made the app and that's who collected all of the data uploaded to Face App. So Face App is one you don't want to use. And if your kids have already used it, you certainly want to delete it and delete all the content that they uploaded, although it's actually, I think, already too late. That's pretty a done deal. But Face App is a bad app that you don't want to use. And then I read this and I thought that people need to know about this and we need to think about it. Elon Musk, whom you will recognize as, maybe the guy who is thinking most in most far-fetched ways about things that then he's bringing into reality. He made a very elaborate presentation to his company, which is called Neuralink. And if you're not familiar with Neuralink, they are actually, they're developing and then with the plan to install computers, actually like chips, in our brains. And Elon Musk aims to do this in humans. They're already doing it in apparently rats and monkeys. They are installing these brain computers called Neuralink, where human beings are actually merging with machines. So this is a technology advance that he says we are only going to beat the robots by becoming them. Obviously, we will be returning to this subject matter in a future conversation, because I will find somebody with whom we can talk about this in terms of a Christian worldview. This obviously steps over the line of what it means to be human and what it means to live as human beings. And so we're going to, we're just going to talk about that in an upcoming program. Today we have a feast for you. We're going to talk with Ben Johnson here, the rights writer from the Acton Institute, right here at the top of the show. He and I are going to talk about the actions of the House of Representatives and some of the things going on here in the United States in terms of politics. We're also going to talk about the transition at Planned Parenthood, which I think people need to know about. And then there is a case being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court that is at the intersection of life and death and free speech. And again, I think something that we need to be not only aware of, but prepared to participate in terms of the conversations of the day. So you're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back.
This is my right, a right given by God, to live a free life, to live in freedom.
Joining me again today, Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. You can follow him at The Rights Writer. Ben, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Carmen. Good morning.
Almost nothing to talk about today.
Dull day. We're going to twiddle our thumbs and people have to hear that on the air.
Okay, so I'm just going to lead with a little bit of a lineup of what's happened in just the last 48 hours. The U.S. House of Representatives denounced or rebuked the president's tweets, which were directed at four female members of Congress known as the Squad. They denounced those tweets as racist. House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi has since clarified that the House did not call the president racist, but his comments. In a follow-up, there was a resolution seeking to initiate an impeachment inquiry based on the characterization of the president as racist. That failed in a vote of 332-95. But then the House took action late yesterday to bring criminal contempt charges against two members of the president's cabinet, Attorney General Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. And then last night in North Carolina at a reelection campaign rally, the crowd echoed the president's tweet chanting, "Send her back." I just want to know how you're processing all this.
One event at a time. You know, I was watching the original tweet storm when it started among Democrats. It began as intra-party violence on Twitter, basically. AOC's, I believe it's her chief of staff, Chakra Bharti, was attacking a Democrat. You saw the official House Democrat Twitter account attack him. And then a pack that he controlled attacked them, and they were going back and forth. And from an outside perspective, it was fascinating to watch because it was a slow motion train wreck on their side. And then and it was all more identity politics than thou. And you wondered how it could get any more partisan when suddenly President Trump decided to get into the center of it, and made the tweets about people from America going back to their home countries, arguably because he didn't know where they were actually from. But I think that's probably less malice than ignorance. He probably didn't know where most of these people are from. But nonetheless, you have this tweet that goes out telling people to go back to their home countries. And then to me, it was the perfect illustration of what America has become. That you have a Congress where the House has done very little of substance that's been helpful, certainly. Much of it has been intentionally symbolic. And yet they can rally and pass a censure resolution in a moment because a tweet hurt somebody's feelings.
Yeah, I think that pretty well sums it up. I think that, you know, part of my concern is what this makes us look like globally. My husband and I were having a conversation last night, and you know, I'm acknowledging that when we read headline news about places around the world where, let's say, a legislature is bringing criminal charges against senior leaders of a government, we tend to immediately, I tend to assume, you know what, that's because their whole government is corrupt, their whole system is broken, they're just a mess. And I guess I wonder if people around the world today are thinking that of us.
Well, I have to think that they are. I watch a great deal of foreign news, particularly in the UK because it's English language, but English language feed from France and Germany and other places as well. And that's exactly how this is being portrayed. Any form of nuance is immediately lost overseas because they don't have the context. And then, as you say, if there's a criminal charge, the assumption is more or less that the United States is seen as a country that's not really terribly interested in ethics. We're seen as a country that will do whatever we need to do to get what it is that we want. And so we'll elect people who are willing to break the law. And it's just assumed that our leaders are corrupt. So when I first heard about all this, I saw President Trump tweeting about people from Detroit and New York City going back to their home countries. I just shook my head at the sheer level of ignorance that was involved. But the more that I process it, I think there's something really to this. To people in certain parts of the country, New York City or Detroit are different countries. We really aren't one America anymore. And I think that's really what we symbolize, is that America is beyond the point where we were homogenous in the sense that we would all gather together toward one flag and respecting our inalienable freedoms and the human dignity that everyone should have. And now, for partisan advantage, one side, the other, or both is willing to dehumanize their opponents. And I really think that that's what's at the center of this entire movement of identity politics and response to it on these two sides. fighting for a partisan advantage. So from a political perspective, my Republican friends love it because they think that Trump has identified the entire Democratic Party with these four most extreme members who were freshmen and shall we say, because they are freshmen, don't have a great deal of accomplishment under their belt yet and are not terribly popular in their area. But for a lot of people, my Democratic friends think that anyone who could say that if anyone would be willing to say America, love it or leave it, the old line from the Merle Haggard song, you run down this country, Hoss, you're walking on the fighting side of me. People like that are sort of subhuman, redneck knuckle draggers. And they can't imagine sharing a country with those two. And ideologically, they don't share the same intellectual space anymore.
Right. And that is absolutely the conversation that we have to be having as Christians. So two data points as you and I go to the break. If you're listening right now, the top searches last night during the president's speech, the top searches on Google and so this is the dictionary telling us this. So this is how that's where Google answers the question first. So tonight, last night's top searches in order: racism, socialism, fascism, concentration camp, xenophobia, and bigot. And then one more data point as we go to break. We now have a majority non-white population in a number of states across the country. California is now 62.1% non-white, Texas 57.1% non-white, and then right there at the edge, Nevada, Georgia, Florida, Arizona. And then, you know, so we are reaching the stage. We knew this was coming. There's a dramatic demographic shift taking place in the United States of America. We will be a non-white majority country in just a handful of years. And it is time for us to begin processing through our language, the way we feel about things, the way we think about things in terms of who is America and what is America. And it really does not have anything to do with skin color. And that's really the conversation that we're trying desperately to have. So Ben Johnson and I are going to continue our conversation. We're actually going to pivot to a conversation about Planned Parenthood and its upheaval in just a minute here on Mornings with Carmen. Continuing my conversation with Ben Johnson, you can find him online at The Rights Writer. You can also find him at the Acton Institute, at the Acton blog, where he frequently blogs. Ben, let's talk about what's going on at Planned Parenthood. Let me bring people up to speed if they're not aware. The U.S. federal government began implementation of a funding policy through the Department of Health and Human Services. It's a rule change that took effect on Monday following the decision of an 11-judge panel from the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals refusing to block the rule. And here's the HHS rule. The HHS rule prohibits Title X funds from being used to, quote, perform, promote, refer for, or support abortion as a method of family planning. It also requires Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers to financially and physically separate their abortion services from non-abortion services. Obviously, Planned Parenthood doesn't want to do this. Initially, it said through its then president, who is now not the president, Leanna Wynne, that it would follow the new rule. Then it said, no, we're going to pull money from our emergency fund to make up for the shortage. And we think $60 million, well, surely that is a really, really significant hit. I think it's important to remember that although $60 million is $60 million, Planned Parenthood has a $1.5 billion annual budget, a third of which comes from federal tax dollars. And this is just, a portion of that. So Leanna Wynne, who became the president of Planned Parenthood just 10 months ago, is now out. I just want your take on what's going on here.
Well, you've covered all the salient points. You know, this obviously blindsided her. It was very clear. She tweeted about this yesterday. She said that the difference is about a philosophical difference over the future of Planned Parenthood. And it's pretty clear, you know, she's the first medical doctor to be the head of Planned Parenthood in about 50 years. And she had done her best to take this action to try and place Planned Parenthood within the context of a medical provider. And so she would talk about all of the medical services. She talked about the medical reality of abortion. It was very clear Planned Parenthood wanted to treat this as though it's a political organization, which it very much had been, highly politicized under Cecile Richards. Of course, Cecile, the daughter of former governor, the last Democratic governor of Texas to date, Ann Richards, and so a very political person. And she's been replaced by an incredibly political person as well, Alexis McGill Johnson. The board called her a renowned social justice leader, lifelong political organizer, and a tireless advocate for reproductive rights. So the fact of the matter is Planned Parenthood's admitting what we've known for years. It isn't a medical organization. It's a political organization. As you mentioned, if you follow the money, it explains everything. They get $500 million a year from U.S. taxpayers. And ever since Wen has been in this position, the Trump administration has been eating her lunch. The Title X initiative is just one aspect. There have been multiple aspects where federal funding has been denied in drips and drabs. Preserving the Hyde Amendment is a major aspect of this, which prevents federal funding of abortion through Medicaid. And then states have been on the march, and there's been very little that's been done on the other side of the ledger. So she's been bounced out. By the way, in the middle of contract negotiations and just weeks after she had a miscarriage.
Mm. Yeah, there's no heart in this, right? And so I think that when we talk about the subject, you know, I think that it's sometimes easy for us, Ben, to talk about Planned Parenthood, again, as a political organization, which it clearly is, and lose sight of what's really happening. And what's really happening is that this is an organization that is actively bringing the lives of the next generation of Americans to an end. Like, right? That is really what Planned Parenthood is doing. It's making the next generation of Americans smaller.
Yeah, by the hundreds of thousands. And, you know, when you look at particularly Johnson, who's going to be heading this organization, she came at this from New York City. And you know, she said that what had inspired her was a billboard urging African-Americans not to have abortions because they have the majority of abortions in the city of New York City, even though they're a minority population there. One issue, by the way, that's going to come up is the fact that she proclaims herself as a Christian. I don't want anyone to question the faith of anybody named Johnson, but I have to question the content of that faith at any rate. You know, she's won awards from Christian groups, both Protestant and Catholic, and she said that abortion needs to be left to a woman, her doctor, and her God. So you could see in the coming weeks and months under her leadership, however long it may persist, that you could see her making a faith-based argument in favor of abortion. And that's something that those of us who believe in the apostolic faith that goes all the way back to the very beginning and foundation of Christianity and even its antecedent in the Old Testament would believe that that is contrary to our understanding of the scriptures going all the way back to the earliest time of the church.
Well, and that gets us to the rights conversation. You know, there is a conversation right now about unalienable rights. I think that we would obviously start with the right to life as being the most unalienable of rights. But there are people who believe that there is a right to abortion. As the rights writer, can you address that?
Well, and this is going to be a major discussion. The Trump administration just has a federal panel that's investigating this. I believe Secretary Pompeo, who's appointing the board. But the issue is that he said that there's been a great deal of rights inflation across the board, that our founding fathers talked about the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. John Locke spoke about life, liberty, and property. Those are the inalienable rights that have been received as part of our Western heritage and codified in our law and our very founding documents. So those are the rights that we would understand as being pivotal and most important. Over time, though, you have not only the right to abortion, which was codified in Roe v. Wade, but the right to taxpayer-funded abortion for many people. That's something that the extreme advocates of abortion on demand are saying. People should have the right to reproductive health care without respect to their ability to pay, is usually the way they phrase it. And what that means is taxpayer-funded abortion. And obviously, no one has a right to end the life of another person outside of due process of the law, and the life of an innocent person cannot be ended by any means whatsoever. So that in itself excludes the right to an abortion except in order to save the life of the mother. So that in itself is an issue of rights, because the child has an inalienable right to life. The child is a separate, distinct human being created in the image of God, endowed with all the faculties, separate DNA, a separate human being who, because of that unique identity, should be conferred with all of the rights that that are given by God, and those rights should be respected. They cannot be given or taken away by government. They can only be respected or denied.
This is going to be an ongoing conversation that you and I are going to have, because the conversation about whether or not there is a hierarchy of rights, I think, is going to be the conversation that we are going to need to be equipped to have. And so, Ben, you and I can continue this conversation in the future, but let's both be thinking about that. I know you already are thinking about it, but I guess I better start thinking about it more clearly so that when we talk, I'm better prepared. How's that sound?
Well, you're always prepared as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, life is at the head of the list for a reason. Without the right to life, all the other rights are completely and utterly meaningless. So.
Well, amen. All right. Hey, thanks. Ben Johnson, the rights writer. You guys can find him at the Acton blog. And you can also find him online at the rights writer. We'll be right back. Take our rights off the field. So a couple of days ago, the monument depicting Calvin. These are reformers, by the way. These are guys who led the Protestant Reformation in the 15th century. And there is a monument to them. It's called the Reformation Wall. It's in Geneva, and it depicts Calvin, Farrell, Beazie, and Knox. And it appeared covered with paint in rainbow colors. The city of Geneva has filed a complaint. This is actually just the latest in a series of, I don't know what I would call them. It's not just vandalism. It's attacks against all kinds of Christian sites, and not just in, well, I mean, surprisingly, maybe to you in Switzerland, but actually across Europe. And so I guess I'm wondering, when we here in America see a church vandalized, what do we think and how do we respond? And then how is that different in places around the world where the Christian sites are actually owned by the government? And so our perspective on it here, when something happens at a church, is that it's an attack on a local community, a local expression of the faith. Because, you know, we're going to have to then ask the question, who's going to not only clean it up, but did they have insurance and those kinds of things? I'm thinking here, let's say, of the arson of a church. We then know that local community or that denomination is ultimately, you know, responsible for what's happening there with the property. And so if you've ever had anything like vandalism at your local church, it's very personal. We take it very personally. In Europe, it is a little bit different, because the churches and these historic Christian sites are actually owned by the government. And so I wanted to talk with Per Uhrt. You will remember him as the author of Sherlock, The Case of the Empty Tomb. He's the director of the Clapham Institute in Sweden. And he's going to join us to just talk about what's going on the religious freedom front across Europe, and in particular, what's happening in terms of this rise of vandalism, might be the short form way of talking about it, but these attacks on churches and Christian sites, particularly in France, but actually all across Europe. So that's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
William Shakespeare is well known for some timeless and inspiring poems and plays. Perhaps one of the most famous is "To Thine Own Self Be True." Hi, this is Callie Breeze with Thrivent, helping you be wise and thrive. It's easy to do what everyone else is doing, or follow the trends, or keep up with the Joneses. But being true to yourself and what God has called you to do is how you fulfill your life calling. And you should look at how you manage your money in the same way. Are your financial actions and decisions being driven by your faith and values? Or are you just doing things to just get by or please someone else? There are so many money choices you make every day. Some are small, some are big, some are short-term, some are long-term. But they are all important, because together they paint a picture of your life. So think about how you make your money choices. Make sure they match up with your faith. Be true to yourself and to God's plan for you. And that is how to be wise and thrive.
We are strangers. We are we are not of this
Returning to Mornings with Carmen is Per Ewert. He is the director of the Clapham Institute in Sweden. He tweets at Per Ewert, and I will spell that for you, P-E-R-E-W-E-R-T. He's the author of Sherlock, The Case of the Empty Tomb. Per, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's so great to be back with you again.
Oh, it's lovely to have you. So you are on holiday, am I correct? This is summer,
yeah.
So this is holiday in Sweden. So
for
North Americans who do not have this kind of lovely schedule, tell us what that means in Sweden.
During this part of July, Sweden more or less closes down, so everybody are sort of in a standstill. So people sit and relax in their tents, in their caravans, in a cottage in the forest. So things are very, very low key at the moment in Sweden.
Okay, it sounds absolutely idyllic. Everyone who's listening right now is wishing they had a cottage in the forest or a hammock hanging next to a tree. Let me ask this question, and because I've already Googled it, I know the answer, and I think you're going to delight people when you tell them this. What is the weather like right now in Sweden?
The weather is as I'd like it to be, not too hot and not too rainy. It's very good, actually.
Yeah, so for people who are listening, they're not going to break 80. They're not going to break 80 for the next, 10 days. And it's
they only have
10% chance of rain. Like, it's lovely. It's just absolutely, it just sounds idyllic. I think you should invite us all over.
Please welcome. Not all at the same time, but in groups.
In groups. Okay, so one of the things that we might do if we came in groups in the summer to Sweden is this conference that that has been held, and I'm probably going to mispronounce it,
Almedalen.
In
Visby. Yeah.
Tell us about the Almedalen conference.
Yeah, it's Sweden's largest political gathering where all the party leaders hold a speech each evening, and everybody who is interested and active in Swedish society in some way are there. So it's quite an important place to be.
Okay, and so...
And we at the Institute, we regularly hold seminars as well every summer. This year we did one on the relationship between Sweden and Israel and one on late-term abortions.
And so how were those received? Because as I survey what it looks like happens and who is gathered, it looks to me as if the worldview presented is not Christian, not expressly Christian, certainly. Tell me how your presentations were received.
Yeah, so that's why we find it so important to be an active Christian voice in that arena, especially in the secularized nation that Sweden is. And we are usually quite a number of Christian organizations who turn up because we feel it's so important to be there and to express another voice.
So give people a little sense of when you talk about a secular worldview, when you talk about a secular nation, give people a little bit of a sense of what the conversations are that dominate this event, because the Christian worldview does not dominate the event. What is the dominant worldview presented at the event?
I'd say it is the most dominating worldview that regulates Sweden, which is a secular individualism. As you know, you may have studied the world values chart. We are in the top right-hand corner as the world's arguably most secular and individualistic nation. That is seen and that is heard in the party leader's speeches, where it's taken for granted that the values that we start out with and the values we want to spread in Sweden and internationally are these values, the very radically secular individualistic values.
So, Per, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in terms of religious freedom or religious liberty and how Christians, are viewed and treated. In a secular individualistic society like Sweden, what is the experience of a Christian and a Christian family?
It's quite double, actually. Both that you feel this pressure all over the area, all over the field, both through media, through school, which is weird because we have a good national curriculum in Sweden, which took effect when the Christian Democrats were in government, which actually says that we need to build on five quite biblical values, actually, the preservation of the human dignity and so on. And it's actually stated explicitly that it's supposed to build on Christian and Western humanist values. But in reality, the Swedish school, and there have been several reports on this, empirical reports, showing that the reality in the classroom, both from teachers and from other pupils, are vehemently contra Christian values and Christian faith. Islam is often accepted because it's so very non-Christian, but the values reflected in school and in media are very much secular, individualistic.
So, Per, when we come back, I'd like for you to talk more broadly about the church in Europe and religious freedom issues and the rise in attacks on Christian churches across Europe. Per Ewert is my conversation partner. He's the director of the Clapham Institute in Sweden. He tweets at Per Ewert. He is also the author of Sherlock, The Case of the Empty Tomb. We'll be right back. Right now in Washington, D.C., Secretary of State Pompeo is holding the second International Religious Freedom Ministerium with leaders from across the world. And they are talking about the desire to really fan the flame of grassroots movements around the globe that would support religious liberty and religious freedom. Joining me now is Per Ewert from the Clapham Institute in Sweden. And he and I are talking about religious freedom and the challenge that Christians face, particularly in Europe. So, Per, let's just bring Europe into focus. And why don't you highlight for us some of the things going on in terms of the Christian experience in relationship to, you know, acceptance and religious liberty or religious freedom?
Yeah, yeah. We see that these are values that are threatened and rights that are threatened. We actually have one of our board members who attend the conference you just mentioned in Washington.
Wonderful.
To bring international examples and advice home, but also to highlight European and the Swedish example, because the situation is, as we know, troublesome in several Islamic and communist nations and have been for a while with a large persecution. The problem is that it's spreading also in Western democracies, Sweden also. And we have a Swedish State Council for Crime Prevention who publishes annual reports on persecution on different kind of hate crimes. And what they see is that hate crimes, the really dangerous hate crimes against Christians, are increasing steadily. On violence and actual threats, mostly on former Muslims who have converted to Christianity. So it's a really urgent situation in Europe and in Sweden.
So when we talk about conversion, I think that's an interesting point. So what you are seeing is not necessarily the targeting of Christians who, you know, sort of were born and raised in the Christian community or in the Christian faith. But you are seeing the targeting of people who are converting to Christianity from Islam.
Yeah, there are two different threads who may run parallel, actually. We have the traditional attacks on churches and Christian places or buildings or signs that people desecrate for some kind of ideological purpose. It may be radical feminists, it may be radical Muslims. But on the other hand, we have these more dangerous persecution directed at people and their lives, and those mostly directed at former Muslims.
We also see what I would just describe as just gratuitous vandalism of Christian churches and Christian sites.
Precisely.
Tell us about tell us about sort of the uptick in that, what you're seeing.
Yeah, there seems to be a huge rise in this, especially in France. I read a piece that you actually sent me describing how the anti-Christian attacks on churches and on other places have quadrupled between 2008 and 2018. And we see these kinds of attacks on Christian sites and also on Jewish sites. So we see that these perpetrators are often Muslims as well, exactly the same case as for the converts.
And so when we talk about, you know, when we talk about pluralism, we tend to think of, you know, a desire to live peaceably with our neighbors and allowing them the freedom of their beliefs, assuming that they will then allow us the freedom of our beliefs. But that is not exactly what you are seeing. And I the reason that I am, you know, inviting you to talk about this and pressing you to talk about this, because I think that, you know, what you are experiencing in secular Europe is certainly headed this direction as America becomes a more secular country.
Precisely. It would have been difficult for me to discuss this with you some 20 years ago. You wouldn't have understood it. Christianity was taken so much for granted in America. But when I see America from the outside, I see that the same forces that have been active in Europe and in Sweden for 50, 60, 70 years have been quite active in America the last decade, am I right?
Absolutely. And so if you could roll the clock back in Sweden and in Europe for a period of a number of years, is there something that you would say to the Christians in preparation for or maybe it, as a way of potentially avoiding, like, right? I guess I'm looking for, hey, can you, as a prophet who has already walked the journey, can you look back over your shoulder and talk to us who are following along in this path and give us some advice in terms of the way forward?
Precisely. I'm doing my PhD thesis on the development of how Sweden became this extremely secular, individualistic nation. And are there specific events in Swedish history and processes that have drawn us in this particular direction? And I have found that there are a number of those, both in politics, in education policy, and also in church policy, where especially interesting for Christians, how the Church of Sweden, the former state church, was so much influenced by the social democratic agenda, the basically atheistic agenda of the social democratic government, that they took over the church with from within. They didn't exclude it, they didn't forbid it, but they changed the Church of Sweden from within to become some kind of secularized Lutheran, where the biblical values were not important anymore, but the church was more or less taken over and is now basically a social democratic propaganda organization.
Okay, when you use the term social democratic, that is pricking the ears of some of our listeners who are hearing that language in American politics for the first time. And, you know, without asking you to make an expressly political statement, if Christians could choose between any other form of capitalistic government and a social democratic form of government, do you see one as aligning more with a Christian worldview than the other?
Yeah, probably. But the important thing is, when I studied the Swedish source material, I was expecting to find a stronger struggle for Marxist values and planned economy and so on. And that was strong until the Second World War. But then things changed into a more individualistic, liberal ideology within social democracy. And I guess that's part of what you see in America as well, where you have one conservative movement and you have another opposing movement, which is some kind of combination between social democratic, Marxist, and liberal values. And those values changed Sweden strongly, especially during the 1960s. And that combination was, well, took Sweden into a whole new position where Christian values are being threatened and oppressed and opposed very strongly by the state.
That is a fascinating observation. Now I can hardly wait to read your dissertation. So get busy. You know, don't stay on holiday too long.
I have two more years to work with it.
Okay, well, we really...
Research is a slow process.
Research is a slow process. Absolutely. I really do think, though, this observation that, you know, what we are not really talking about Marxism. We really are talking about this individualized version of a socialist democratic formula. And it is different than Marxism. And we do need to learn how to understand that, because for Americans, We're certainly not talking about a collective, but we are talking about everybody getting absolutely their own way and thinking that everybody else is going to pay for it. And that is just not going to there is no system that's going to provide that. So, Pear, thank you so much. Back to the little cottage in the woods. Have a lovely holiday. Yeah. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Pear Ewert. You can find him online at the Clapham Institute. You can also find him at Pear Ewert. We'll be right back. Okay, thank you to the person making the observation that I am a geek. Okay, I recognize that. There are definitely things that fascinate me and people who fascinate me, and I might geek out a little bit when I hear them talking about things that I think, wow, that really, those threads, how they're tying them together, those points on the out there that seem totally disconnected. I love the way that Pear drew together the Christian worldview, the challenges of Western civilization, the social democracy experiment in Sweden, and how it's really not supporting the religious rights of now minority Christians, and what that portends for the United States as we, as we flirt with socialism on several fronts. So I found it fascinating. I hope that it inspires you to think about the landscape ahead of us and live out your religious freedom today in a robust way. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen, and we'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.